The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we have David Weatherly here in studio. Well, not in studio, I'm sorry, on the phone with us. How you doing, David?
Hey, sir, I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing great. And you are most recently the author of The Black-Eyed Children.
That's correct.
And when did that come out?
It came out last year. It's been almost a year now.
Okay. And You've been involved in the paranormal for what, over 35 years now?
That's correct, yeah.
How did you get in?
I started investigating when I was a teenager.
Oh, okay. So you just always had an interest in it?
Yeah, I sure did. I grew up interested in unusual things, so to speak. And this was, showing my age a little bit, this was in the 70s. And at the time, there really wasn't a whole lot out there. I mean, people today who are interested have it easy because there's so many paranormal shows on and books and everything else. But, when I got interested, there really were only a few things coming out. Eric Von Däniken was writing on Ancient Aliens. I read that stuff when I was a kid. Hans Holzer was writing on haunted sites. And I was just reading everything I could find that was in that vein. And then, of course, In Search Of came along. Hosted by Leonard Nimoy, and that was, that was just kind of a dream come true at that point. It was a show all about paranormal topics and mysteries and everything. So, those things, all sparked my interest, and I grew up in a really rural area, but had a, I always say that these kind of things, they find you, and that was sort of what happened to me, because this elderly couple moved close to us, and I started going over and visiting with this woman, and it turned out she was a spiritualist. And we're talking about, Eastern North Carolina. She was probably the only spiritualist in that half of the state at the time. all of a sudden, here's this woman that has delved into all of these things, spiritualism and, psychic phenomena and these different topics, and it was like, wow, here's somebody to actually talk to and engage about these things. And it's kind of a funny story. I always tell people that, I went over one day and she was reading Fate magazine. And Fate magazine back then was a little digest-sized magazine that just covered all areas of the paranormal, from Bigfoot to UFO sightings to, everything else.
That was
I've never seen it.
That was one of the things that helped me get deeper into the paranormal, was finding Fate magazine.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was eye-opening to me, because I had never seen this thing before.
Yeah.
I asked her, I said, what is this? She said, what's Fate magazine? Don't you know what it is? And I started looking through it, and I was like, oh, my gosh. And she said, make sure you visit after school tomorrow. So I went over there the next day, and she presented me with this huge box of Fate magazine. She says, I don't need these anymore. Why don't you take them?
Wow.
And, I was curious enough. I was sick from school for a while. Just sort of, barricaded myself in my room and read through this stuff. And it was like, oh my gosh. All of a sudden, that was a real turning point, because I realized, my God, there's people all over the place investigating these things. And, I've never looked back since then. I've done the same thing.
Nice, nice. And yeah, you're a writer for Intrepid magazine?
Mm-hmm.
And what is that about?
Yeah, that's correct. Intrepid magazine is actually an online magazine that is done by subscription. It's produced by Scotty Roberts, who is an author himself. He wrote Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, excellent book on that topic, came out last year. And he's also the gentleman who puts on the Paradigm Symposium. The first one was in 2012. There's another one coming up this year. And I spoke there last year. I'll be there again in 2013. And it's an amazing gathering of people.
Where is that?
Interested in these. It's in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
And it'll be in October. And if you go to intrepidmag.com, you can find out about how to subscribe to the magazine. There's a blog on there. You also see information about the Paradigm Symposium. And they've got a stellar lineup every year. This year, Giorgio Tsoukalos from Ancient Aliens will be there. L.A. Marzulli. Just a whole range of people that, you know, speaking on all these different topics. And it's an amazing event. It's very professional. It's a great group of people.
Nice. All right, well, let's get into your most recent book, The Black-Eyed Children. How did you come across this phenomena, first of all?
Well, I first heard about the phenomena in the late 90s, the early days of the Internet. Stories started showing up that talked about these black-eyed kids. And the most famous story, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard, was from a journalist in Texas, a gentleman named Brian Bethel. And he encountered a pair of these kids in the parking lot. The encounter was fairly brief. You know, he had went to this strip center to pay a bill. He was sitting in his car writing a check, and these two kids approached his car, tapped on the window. He was kind of uneasy, you know. He was a little bit nervous because he was writing a check, but, you know, here are these two kids all of a sudden at his car. He rolled the window down just a little bit and started talking to them, and they basically were requesting a ride. But they were acting a little bit odd. They were saying strange things, and they said, "Hey, mister, you know, we forgot our money at home, and we want to see this movie. Can't you just take us to our house?" Yeah. Well, Buffalo had the mindset, you know, it was clear enough to sit there and sort of think about this, and he glanced over the movie marquee and realized that the movie they wanted to see was, I don't know, it was like two-thirds finished or something. So it didn't make any sense. And as he's engaging with them, he realizes suddenly at some point, looking at them closer, that their eyes are solid black. And that's sort of enough for him. He puts the window up and he drives away and gets away from these kids. So, you know, his was one of the early encounters that was posted on the Internet. When he put it up, a lot of people really responded to this and started saying, "Oh my gosh, I've seen something similar to this. You know, what is this? What are these kids?" People had a lot of questions. And a few other stories started surfacing that really made the rounds. And being interested in all aspects of the paranormal, I had read those accounts and sort of filed them away, you know, in my filing cabinet in my brain and thought, okay, this is interesting, it's weird. It's right on the border. It could be urban legend or there could be something more to it. Didn't really think a whole lot about it until a few years later. This gentleman approached me. He was someone I knew, saw on a fairly regular basis. His name was Paul. His story is chronicled in my book. And Paul is, you know, think of a modern-day John Wayne. This guy, he's well over 6 feet tall. He's a prison guard, no nonsense, professes an absolute complete disbelief in anything paranormal, and he knew what I did, and he couldn't resist making cracks about it whenever he saw me. You know, "Oh, if you catch a flying saucer this week," and things like that. Well, you learn over time that people who can't leave something like that alone, it's often because they're haunted by something themselves, and that indeed is what the case was with Paul. So he joined me for lunch one day, and, you know, here's this tough guy virtually breaking down, telling the story. And his story was about an encounter with a pair of these black-eyed kids that showed up at his house. And his account, you know, he went home, he lived in a suburban neighborhood, was in the kitchen making something to eat, and was home alone. His wife and child were out of town. And he heard this long, continuous rapping at the door. You know, as a lot of us would do, he sort of paused and was puzzled by it, you know, thinking, right. "Why, you know, is somebody knocking? Why are they using the doorbell? What is..." So the knocking just won't stop. Paul goes to the door. He opens his front door, and there's two kids, about 10 years old, standing on his steps. They're, in very nondescript clothing, you know, jeans and hoodies that are in drab colors. They're sort of looking down at their shoes or the ground. Their skin, from what he can see of it, is very pale. And when he opens the door, they say something to the effect of, hey, we thought we'd come in for a little bit.
Yeah, so they didn't even ask to come in? They just kind of said they were going to come in?
It's just kind of a statement, you know, and it's very common in these accounts that these kids, they'll just make these statements, you know, and they'll say, hey, what? You know, they'll say things like, hey, why don't you invite us in for a bit? You know, it's very common for them to make a request such as, hey, mister, we need to use the phone. Will you ask us in to use the phone? But you see, they're always trying to elicit an invitation. And that was sort of the case when these kids showed up at Paul's doorstep, and they said something to this effect, and he, you know, he being a no BS guy, just kind of shakes his head, and he, you know, says, I think you guys have the wrong house. And, you know, their response is something like, well, we can come in anyway. And, you know, the thing is, when Paul opened that door, initially he related to me that as soon as he opened the door and saw these kids, he was a little bit uneasy.
Right, right.
And this is typical in these encounters. The victims go through three stages. It's usually being just feeling uneasy, to being very nervous, to being outright frightened. And this is sort of what Paul went through. Now, Paul, being uneasy and trying to, you know, call on his normal nature, he decides that he wants to get a better look at these kids, and he sort of steps forward a little bit. When he does, they look up at him, and he realizes that the eyes are solid black. Now, this is not just the people. I see people all the time saying, well, you know, it's kids with, you know, whatever the skeptical, you know, excuses and, you know, that all these people are mistaken or, you know, they're not really solid black eyes. No, these are solid black eyes. The entire sclera is solid black. And when Paul sees this, he just recoils back into his home, slams the door, walks across the room into his living room, realizing that he's frightened, and this is a man who's not used to feeling this emotion. So he's completely frightened, and he's sort of pacing around as he realizes that he's shaking. And as he's doing this, sort of trying to come to grips with himself, he hears this rapping noise, and he turns and looks at the front door. His door is one of those that has the glass panes framing the door, and peering in through one of those panes is the face of one of these kids tapping on the window. Yeah. Because they still want him.
Right.
And, you know, if that's not a creepy image, I don't know what is. But, you know, Paul, in that moment, sort of snaps from fear to anger. He runs to his bedroom. He grabs his firearm, which is on the nightstand. He comes back out. He told me that the only thing he could think of in that time was he wanted to terrify those kids the way they had frightened him. But when he yanks the door open, there's nothing there. Huh. He goes onto his steps. He goes out in the yard, up and down the street. There's no sign of these kids anywhere. And again, this is very typical of these encounters.
Wow. And we should probably address the most common skeptical explanation, which really isn't skepticism. It's more just disbelief. Because real skepticism questions everything. It doesn't just try to disprove something. And the explanation that some skeptics say is that it's mydriasis, and that especially in young children, it causes the pupils to get larger, and that the whole eye really isn't black and people are just mistaken.
Right. You know, I looked at all of the logical possibilities, as anyone who reads the book will see, and I explored the medical possibilities, as well as the, you know, the possibilities of hoax. And as far as you know, medical explanations for this, I talked to a number of medical professionals. There's a couple of diseases. There's one called mydriasis. There's another called aniridia. And these, first of all, they're fairly rare. Second of all, they don't really necessarily cause the eyes to turn black. They will change or alter the pupil. It roughly translates as a blown pupil, the disease, which means that pupil enlarges. But I've looked at a lot of photographs of people who have these diseases, and I've shown them to some of the people who have witnessed these black-eyed children. This is not what they're seeing. Typically, a lot of the pictures I've seen, when someone has one of these diseases, it actually makes the white of the eye stand out all the more because of the alteration of the pupil. It looks very unnatural, and against that white background of the rest of the eye, it's a real stark difference. So, you know, I'm convinced that that's not what these people are seeing. The other thing I hear very often is that, oh, it's some kind of drug use. Well, you know, according to all the professionals I've spoken to, there's not any kind of known drug that turns the entire eye solid black.
Right.
The other thing with these medical explanations is that, you know, the people who have these conditions, as I said, they're fairly rare diseases, and this makes the eyes incredibly sensitive. These people, they're seeking treatment. They're not running around trying to knock on strangers' doors. they're trying to cure their condition and being very careful with it. So, it's a rather silly argument.
Well, how many cases do you think you've found of this?
That are genuine, I've investigated hundreds of them. And it's interesting because, you know, these cases, the numbers are climbing rapidly. You and I were talking a little bit earlier off air, and it's amazing. I know several other independent investigators who are collecting these accounts, and every day, practically, I'm getting emails or contacts from people and some of these other investigators, and they're all different accounts. They're all from different places, from different people, and something is going on that's making these accounts grow at a really amazing number.
And do you think the accounts are growing, or do you think that people are just talking about them more?
Yeah, it's a combination of things, you know, because I'd say about half of what I get, probably two-thirds of what I get, are accounts that have happened over the last few years that people are suddenly realizing, oh my gosh, that's what I saw. I can't tell you how many emails I get that say, you know, they start off typically with something like, I never knew what this was that I encountered, but everything I'm hearing about these black-eyed kids, it fits, and here's what happened to me.
Wow.
So, you know, it's funny because even so many of the people I interviewed for the book, you know, they would say, I don't think anyone else has ever seen this. You know, I don't think this is happening to anybody else, but it is.
All right. Well, see, and the thing is, if you've investigated so many of these cases, to say that every single one of those people were wrong about the eyes in order to provide your, you know, debunked explanation is kind of ridiculous. It's not taking the actual facts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, have there ever been any evidence of these things ever show up on camera? Anyone ever get a picture of them? Anything like that?
Now, you know, it's funny because, first of all, I'm not big on looking for a photograph of these things because a photograph's not going to convince anybody.
Well, no.
You know, it's not going to convince a skeptic, and a believer doesn't need it. So photographic proof in this case is going to be questionable anyway because it's so easy to digitally manipulate a picture, you know, in a couple of seconds.
Yeah, especially
today. You know, videos can go on and make anyone be a black-eyed person.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, here's something that's very interesting. There have been accounts wherein there were security cameras present, and when the encounter occurred, these cameras experienced malfunctions, whether it was a missing piece of time off the tape, or the system went down, you know, static on the cameras, weird things have happened. And that's really interesting. I mean, then we get into territory that compares these kids to accounts of the Men in Black, for instance, where there's a lot of, you know, electronic interference and strange things happening to electronics when these figures are around.
And when I heard about this, that was the first thing that came to mind, is kind of the oddness of the Men in Black encounters.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, Nick Redfern is a friend of mine, and he's written extensively on the Men in Black, and it hasn't escaped either one of us that there are very strange similarities between Men in Black accounts and encounters with these black-eyed kids.
And at the same time, yet, they're very different on other levels.
Yes,
so,
that's correct.
What are the most common elements that you see? Like, how old are the kids, for instance?
Most common elements with the encounters in general, or between the kids and the Men in Black?
The encounters in general.
Oh, I see. Well, first of all, of course, they're the solid black eyes.
Right.
The skin of these children is variously described as being pale, pasty. Some people even say it looks artificial. Here's a curious thing: out of all of the accounts that I've had, no one has ever noticed a blemish on the skin of these kids.
Wow.
No freckles, no pimples, no acne, nothing. And, you know, these kids, in general, the most common age we hear is 10 years old.
Uh-huh.
The range goes from about 8 to early teens. And, you know, of course, those teen and preteen years, you know, you would expect acne and things like that. You would also expect kids in this range to have, you know, a cell phone, an iPod, something like that. No one ever notices anything like that. The kids always seem to dress in very nondescript clothing, as if they're trying to blend in or not be noticed. And there's a percentage of cases that we hear that the clothing looks ill-fitting or as if it's homemade, some people have said. Yeah, I've had a few people say that the kids look like they are dressed like Amish kids would be dressed.
Huh.
So you hear a few variations in the clothing. And then there's the speech. The speech is always described as being very monotone or cold. The kids seem to repeat phrases over and over again. They are very insistent about that they want something. They always make a request. They want you to invite them inside. They want you to ask them to get in your car, your vehicle, so they can go for a ride. It's always trying to elicit an invitation into your personal space.
And why do you think they need an invitation?
Well, you know, here's one of the weird things about these kids. The black-eyed children, when I started investigating this phenomenon, it was a little bit startling how many different types of paranormal manifestations they had things in common with. And you could, you know, we've already addressed the Men in Black. You could argue that these things are alien hybrids. You could argue that there's some kind of demonic entity. You know, you talk about needing an invitation inside, then we're getting into classical demonology or even, traditional vampire lore.
Right,
you know,
right.
These undead creatures, they need an invitation. Demonology, you know, says that a demonic entity can't enter, whether it's your home or your body, unless you invite it in somehow. So, you know, this certainly implies that there's something that restricts these children from forcing themselves in, that they need that opening created somehow.
Hmm. All right. Well, is there a more common time that people have these experiences?
It's very common in the late afternoon, early evening. You know, now part of that, I believe, is that a lot of the encounters occur at homes, and it seems to be, you know, when people have just gotten home from work, are going home from work, things like that. But But, you know, there are encounters early morning and in the middle of the night and so forth, too.
Okay. One of the biggest questions people have asked me about this that they wanted me to ask you is, has anyone ever let them in?
Well, there's a couple of accounts, and there's one that's detailed in the book. It takes up a whole chapter, as a matter of fact. And it's a pretty strange story. It's a bit disturbing. And the short version of it is that a woman was driving home from work with her 10-year-old son in the back seat of her SUV. She stopped at a convenience store to pick up a couple items, and she parked right in front. She jumped out, leaving her son in the vehicle. And she was only a couple of minutes. She came back out. You know, on autopilot, like many of us would do, she jumped in the vehicle, putting the key in the ignition and turning it as she's looking in the rearview mirror. And as she's looking, she sees this boy sitting in the middle of the back seat, right beside her son. He's staring in the rearview mirror at her, and he has solid black eyes. Now, she has an immediate fear reaction. She jumps out of the car. She jerks open the back door, pulls her son out, and rushes back to the convenience store. Fast forwarding a little bit, she had been too nervous to get back in her SUV, so her husband came to the store. She did not tell him what had occurred, merely that she wanted to switch vehicles. So she took his vehicle, went home. He took the SUV. A few miles away, he was in an accident and totaled it. Ended up in the hospital. Couldn't remember exactly what had happened. He said the last thing he remembered was that he detected some kind of foul odor in the SUV.
Interesting. Now,
the doctors at the hospital thought that there was some kind of gas leak that had caused him to pass out. He was convinced that it wasn't gas. He thought it was something that was just rotting, is how he described it. So, as the mother is dealing with the child, she's, you know, trying to determine exactly what went on. And she's asking him the questions that any parent would ask. She said, you know, who is that boy? Do you know that boy from school? And he says, well, no, Mommy, I don't know him. And she said, well, why did he get in our car? And her son answers, well, I asked him to get in, Mommy. I thought we could go to my house and play.
Huh. So obviously the negative vibe didn't affect the little kid that much, apparently.
That's correct. So, you know, we see in this a couple of things. One is that obviously the child did not recognize anything wrong with this black-eyed child. You know, she even asked her son, you know, did you notice anything unusual or odd about him? And this little boy said no. Now, you know, kids of that age, they're much more open-minded about such things, unless they've been taught otherwise about, you know, from their parents. They're not apt to really pay attention to things, you know, that are different about another person in terms of, you know, deformities or skin color or any simple thing.
Right.
So this child clearly, you know, didn't faze him. And we also see that this black-eyed child did still need an invitation. And was able to elicit it from this boy. So this black-eyed kid climbed over this young boy into the SUV and sat down right beside him in the middle of the back seat. The further result from this encounter was that the boy's father got out of the hospital. He was fine. He just had some minor injuries. But this young boy who had been in such close contact with this black-eyed kid became sick.
Oh.
And when the parents took him to the doctors, doctors were really puzzled. They couldn't diagnose what was wrong with this child because every time they thought they knew what was wrong, the symptoms would change.
Now, that's weird.
It was very weird. And, you know, this went on for quite some time. They diagnosed a whole range. You know, they said, oh, he's, you know, he's got a virus. And then they said, you know, they thought he had appendicitis at one point. And then he broke out and they said, oh, he's got the measles. And you know, all these different things. And of course, the family hadn't told the, you know, physicians that, you know, a black-eyed kid showed up and sat down beside him, obviously. I just wanted to know what was wrong with their son. But as this was unfolding, they started sort of putting the pieces together, and they ended up taking their son home and just having, you know, family members and friends constantly watch over this boy and pray and focus positive energy and everything else. And the young man did eventually recover, but he was sick for quite some time.
Wow. Okay. Hang on 1 second. We'll be back in 30 seconds with David Weatherly.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we are here with David Weatherly, author of The Black-Eyed Children. So, David, are kids commonly interacting with these black-eyed children, or is it normally adults?
No, in fact, this is the account that I just shared with you is very rare. These black-eyed children seem to show up almost exclusively to adults.
Huh. Do the people who meet them have any kind of history of paranormal accounts, like before this or after they have these experiences?
They actually don't. And, you know, I worked extensively at the people who encounter these kids to try to find patterns and things that connect them. For the most part, these are not people who are interested in the paranormal. They're not sitting around watching ghost hunting shows and things like that, and most of them really, you know, they don't report any other experiences similar. You know, they're not people who have sighted UFOs numerous times.
Right.
It was very strange when I started delving into this to try to find some patterns that did link some of the victims. There are a number of people who are claimed to be abductees who have encountered the children.
Okay.
And they are sort of an isolated group within this phenomena because, you know, they're a relatively small number. Two, they're the only people that I really see that don't universally think these things are negative, because they think the kids are some kind of a hybrid being. But, you know, by and large, the bulk of the people who encounter these kids, no interest in the paranormal before or afterwards. One of the few connecting threads I found among these people was that there's a large number of them who work in positions of authority. So there are a lot of accounts from police officers, military personnel, government employees. And, you know, that's a little bit curious. I'm not entirely sure what to make of it yet.
Well, the funny thing is, those are the best witnesses for stuff like this too. The hardest
Absolutely.
To just dismiss.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you sit down and talk with someone, you know, a sheriff's deputy who's encountering these kids. I mean, this is a man who is a trained observer. His life depends on being aware and observing details. And, you know, he has no explanation for what he encountered. It's pretty impressive.
Do you find any similarities, like, in certain areas they happen more than others? Like, you know, how UFOs happen in certain flap areas? Do you have anything like that going on?
Well, geographically, there's not too much. When I first started delving into the phenomena, I initially came up with a lot of sightings in the Midwest. And that started changing the more I looked at it, and I realized, well, there really are sightings, you know, all over the country. And then I started getting a lot of accounts from people in other countries. So, you know, there are accounts from people as far from different parts of Australia, the UK, South Africa, Canada, you know, all over the world at this point.
Wow. It's kind of unusual that for a paranormal phenomenon not to have some kind of pattern.
It makes it all the more curious.
Yeah. How old are these accounts? Like, what are the oldest accounts you have?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of answers to that. One is that there's sort of the modern wave of these accounts that seem to manifest, as I said earlier, in the late 90s when people started posting them on the internet and sharing them. And one of the things I set out to do when I wrote the book was I was determined to see if I could find accounts that predated the internet and television, you know, to say, okay, this is not an urban myth based on, you know, the current media fad of displaying these types of things. Because it's an easy effect to do, you know. A lot of television shows do it now, you know, a lot of the vampire shows and movies show
right.
The solid black eyes and things. And even going back to the 90s, they had the X-Files,
yeah.
Which, you know, used this effect. But the more I delved into it, the more I started digging up old accounts, and I realized the key to finding these older accounts was not looking at it in terms of a, quote, black-eyed child or black-eyed kid. That was the modern interpretation. And one of the first early ones I found that was impressive was from 1950. It was from a very rural area. This young gentleman named Harold was walking home, and there's a community where everyone knows everyone. Harold was a real good-natured guy. He's walking along, he comes to the fence line that leads up to his home, and here's a young boy leaning against the fence, and Harold just starts talking to him. And Harold's sort of rambling on, and you know, suddenly realizes this kid hasn't responded, he hasn't really moved, he's just sort of staring, you know, down, and Harold asks him if he's okay, and this kid responds by saying, "You're going to walk me up to your house. I want to go to your house." And, you know, Harold goes up on the back of his neck, and he's like, "Oh, my gosh." And during this encounter, you know, he realizes this young boy, who he realizes he's never seen him before, this kid has solid black eyes. And Harold is frightened, and he's thinking, he's merely thinking, how fast can I run away from this kid? And in what appears to be mind reading, this black-eyed child immediately responds and says, "Now don't you run away from me.
Wow.
You're going to walk me up to your house." And, you know, the joke is that Harold beat his personal track record that day making it to his house. Now, there's a couple of unique things that happen in this encounter. One is that as Harold is running away from this boy, he hears what he equated to something like the scream of a bobcat behind him.
Huh.
So it's this weird sort of screeching sound. When Harold reaches his house, he bursts through the door and explains to his parents what's happened. The automatic response from his mother is, "Oh my gosh, Harold met the devil." And we're going to have to take you to, you know, the preacher to be cleansed. Now, this is, you know, these people are defining this within the parameters of their culture and time period that they're in.
Right.
And, you know, these are sort of salt of the earth farming people that, you know, God's hearing has an effect. And anything like this, that's how they're going to define it. So, you know, this story, this account survived not with the term black-eyed child. This account survived with the, you know, the notation that old Harold met the devil.
Right. And it almost sounds like something out of the Twilight Zone, really.
It does, doesn't it?
Is that the oldest one you've found so far, or?
I found older accounts when I was in China, researching something else, actually, and ended up realizing that there are Asian accounts that talk about black-eyed beings, and, you know, those get into, now, over there, they classify them as some type of ghost. You know, sometimes
right.
It's called a hungry ghost. Sometimes it will, in parts of Southeast Asia, you'll hear it referred to as on rail, which is a vengeful ghost, and you know, these angry spirits that are stuck for whatever reason, you know, whether they're seeking revenge or whether they're trapped because of some kind of compulsion they had in this incarnation. So, you know, there are some of these accounts where these spirits manifest to people and they look human, except that they have solid black eyes. And these are accounts that are very, you know, cautionary over there. They're saying that, you know, you need to stay away from these kind of spirits because they will attach to you. They will try to take something from you.
Now, are they more commonly boys or girls?
They're more commonly male. There are accounts of female black-eyed children. There are accounts where, you know, we'll see a pair, a boy and a girl, but it does seem male-dominant.
Interesting. That was actually a question from a listener.
I should also add, I have some new leads recently on this that I haven't really talked about much, but a gentleman that is a friend of mine is Native American, and he has stories from his tribal elders that talk about these black-eyed beings having been here for a long time. So it'll be interesting to see how more of that develops.
Huh. How many children usually show up? Is it usually just one or two, or do they show up in larger groups?
It's most common for there to be one or two, yes. Occasionally there are three. But beyond that, we really there's not really any accounts of large groups of them showing up. Yeah.
Do you think this the modern black-eyed children are just a form of something else that has been going on for ages and it's just changed its whole demeanor?
Yeah, I sure do.
Okay.
I sure do. A lot of people, you know, there's a segment of people out there that believe that they're djinn, which is a very old legend out of the Middle East. Now, you know, we've sort of got comical versions almost of the djinn here in the States because of Walt Disney.
Right.
It's been interpreted as the genie, but in traditional terms, the djinn were not something to be trifled with. They're not happy, smiling guys in turbans that are going to grant you wishes. They're tricksters. They tend to be malicious. And there are a lot of different classifications of them when you start exploring Middle Eastern beliefs about the djinn. You know, some of them are not negative, but you know, overall, they're seen as being a race of beings that was essentially banished because they would not bow down to humans. And this is something this is talked about in a lot of classical religious texts over there. Talk about the djinn and how they were banished into some other world, which, you know, to me starts sounding like another dimension.
Yeah,
that's something I've explored a lot anyway, is this idea of other dimensional beings, and that branches into my personal belief as to what these black-eyed beings are. I think there's something interdimensional.
Okay. Now, like with UFO encounters, Jenny Randall's coined the term Oz factor for that unreal feeling or that surreal feeling that people have when they experience UFOs. Does anyone report that with the black-eyed children?
You know, most of the people that are having these experiences with black-eyed kids, by the time I get to talk with them, they're essentially behaving like trauma victims.
Huh.
They usually experience a lot of changes in their day-to-day life after these accounts. You know, people report disrupted sleep patterns. There's a lot of people that have a portion of that fear sort of lingering with them. They're frightened that these kids are going to come back. There's people who have dreams about them. You know, nightmare types of scenarios where they'll dream that, you know, these kids are standing at the door or they're at the window, and, you know, they have a difficult time moving beyond the experience. So some people have a lot of difficulty going back to the location. You know, there's a woman who experienced these kids. She was working at a convenience store, and these kids showed up at the convenience store after it was closed, and she was in the back trying to count money. You know, she worked a night shift, and these kids showed up at the door, and it traumatized her so much that she ended up quitting her job. She went off night shifts and tried day shifts for a little while, but she was so just still so frightened at being in the same environment that she couldn't deal with it anymore.
Are there any other changes people experience as a result?
Any other what?
Any other changes, like any other common after effects?
Yeah, you know, the most common after effects I hear are changes in the sleep patterns, and some people report almost paranoia. You know, they get frightened when someone comes to, they get nervous when someone comes to the door. There are a few other things, but they seem to be more, you know, towards the individuals. You know, some people end up trying to get on medication. Some people seek therapy. What does seem to be very common is that a lot of these people who were usually not spiritual when they had the encounter tend to gravitate towards some type of spiritual path after these experiences. And sometimes it's the religion they grew up in, and sometimes it's something new. And what I often hear is that these people, you know, will say things like, I just want some kind of spiritual comfort to help me be sure these kids won't come back.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. It always makes you wonder if maybe some part of their unconscious is drawing these kids in just to kick them onto that path.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I mean, that's, you know, something else I explored in the book was the idea of tulpas. And that is a being that is essentially created from pure thought.
Right.
And, you know, that's a big question, because one of the odd things that happens in these encounters is that these kids, they vanish suddenly. And it obviously doesn't make any logical sense. You know, when you've got an account such as, you know, this one that I have from a sheriff's deputy, he had two of these kids on the deck of a house, and he was blocking the steps while he was knocking on the door. You know, turned around for a few seconds and looked back, and these kids are gone. Now, to get away from him, they would have had to have leapt off of this elevated deck down to the ground and run away across a wide open yard with no trees. And yeah, it's just not physically possible that they had done that in those few seconds.
And again, that kind of is reminiscent of some Men in Black accounts where they walk out the door and they're just gone.
Right, exactly. So, you know, we're getting into areas where we have to start exploring stranger explanations for such a thing. And, you know, one of them is that, well, if there's some type of tulpa or thought form, you know, something that is projected or created, then yeah, sure, they could vanish like that. If there's something that is dimensional, interdimensional, then yeah, they could probably vanish like that. You know, it's fascinating because Native cultures all over the world, for, you know, their whole, you know, tribal existence, have talked about things like beings who live in other worlds. And they're not talking about other planets. They're talking about, you know, other levels of existence. That's very common to hear around the world from old tales. And it's also very common to hear about these beings that used to live here but left by going through like a shimmering portal or a doorway and things like this.
Right.
And, you know, for a long time people have scoffed at that. Well, you know, to me, we're talking about dimensional travel. And lo and behold, of course, you know, just a few years ago, quantum scientists came out and said, oh, hey, we've figured out there are other dimensions. We don't know how to get to them or what's in them, but we know they're there.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
Now, there's you mentioned the one case with the kid and the mother. Are there a lot of cases where there are multiple witnesses, or is this usually a one-on-one thing?
It's very common that it's just a single experiences each kid. There are a few encounters where there are there's more than one present, or one person present, but by and large, it's just a single person experiencing the kids.
All right. How do you verify these cases? How do you know these people are not making something up or just crazy in some way?
Well, I have a long process that I go through when I interview these people. And, you know, there's plenty of cases that I have pitched out and not reported just because either, you know, there was something inconsistent with the person's account or their story, or you know, there was a possibility of a hoax being perpetrated on them. You know, after being in this field for so long, you know, you learn a lot of subtle signals, you know. When you go to someone numerous times and ask them the same question in different formats and things like that, it's just a lot of ways to determine a person's honesty when you're sitting down talking with them. I think all of us do that, you know, whether it's investigating the paranormal or something else, you know.
Right.
How do you believe anything someone says? You know, you learn to recognize signals and behaviors and things like that, and anyone in an investigative field really has to develop that to some degree, whether you're, you know, private detective or paranormal investigator or whatever it is.
Now, you had, I don't know if you mentioned it tonight, but their movements, you have said, are kind of stiff, like unnatural?
Yes, that's correct. they seem to be very awkward in their mannerisms. There's, you know, there's a few times that, and this goes back to Minute Blast stuff a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of occasions where common items seem to puzzle them. One in particular that I received recently was kind of funny. This woman was at home, and she told me, she said, I guess I was just in a bad mood that day. She was home, and she was doing something in her house, and this knocking started on the door, at the front door. And she was so irritated by the fact that someone was knocking and that they kept doing it, you know, it's this long, continuous knock, that when she finally set the things down or whatever she was doing, she rushed to the front door and she opened it very quickly, stepping out, and before she, you know, these kids even said anything, she pointed at the doorbell and she says, "Why don't you ring the damn doorbell?" And, you know, so then she realizes, you know, there's a kid standing there, and she said it was very odd because they looked at her, and they sort of looked at the doorbell as if they didn't realize what that little round lighted button was. They just looked at it, and then they looked back at her.
Wow.
And, you know, this is very interesting. This goes back to, you know, you read some of the classical Men in Black encounters, and they're puzzled by, you know, an ink pen or a fork.
Yeah, or Jell-O.
They've never seen before.
Yeah, yeah. Have you had any experiences with them?
No, I have not witnessed them that type myself.
Okay, so nothing weird has come of the investigations or anything?
Well, weird things have happened. But I haven't witnessed the kids myself, but I can tell you something strange that did occur. When shortly after the book came out, I received an email from a woman, and she said, it started off, you know, "Don't think I'm crazy." And that's always the flip of a coin, you know, when I get to the inbox. But this woman, you know, she reported that she started reading the book and that her smoke alarm went off. So she cut the smoke alarm off and thought it just needed batteries or something. But the next time she sat down and she was reading the book, the timer on her oven went off. And she was very puzzled. She didn't even recognize the sound because she never uses the timer.
Huh.
So that was a little bit much. But the third thing was that she sat down and started reading the book and her garage door opened itself. So she put the book down and she said, "Listen, I'm really interested in this, but this is too in much, I don't want any encounters with these things.
Right.
Has anyone else reported anything like this? Well, you know, at that point, no one had, but then I started getting a few emails here and there and calls and people saying, hey, you know, is there electronic stuff connecting with these kids because this is happening and this is happening? And the one that really got me was that a friend of mine who's also a paranormal investigator in Kentucky had a copy of the book. He told me one day, and I picked up the phone, there's nothing but static. I thought, okay, well, he pocket dialed, or it was a bad connection, whatever.
Right.
Well, this started happening day after day. I would get calls from his phone, you know, and sometimes several a day. And if I wasn't around, there would be messages on my phone, you know, 15 minutes long of just background noise. And I'm hearing, you know, just sounds, and I'm hearing this kid, and I'm thinking, oh, that's it. He's got a young child. His kid's getting hold of the phone and dialing my number. So I let him know. He apologizes. He says, all right, it won't happen again. Well, of course it did. He suddenly sends me an email. He says, we've got to talk. I got to tell you this. He's sitting on his bed reading the Black Eyed Children book. His phone is on the bed beside him. No one's touching it. It lights up and dials my number. This is crazy. I've never seen this happen. He takes it to his cell phone provider. He says, this phone is dialing this one person's number over and over again. I want you to fix it or tell me why it's doing it. Cell phone people couldn't explain it.
Wow.
Here's the kicker, Soraya. His phone called me one final time. It was sitting on the dashboard of his car. It lit up and dialed my number. The moment he drove into Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Oh, wow. Home of the Mothman.
Home of the Mothman. And men in black sirens and, you know, the Green Man and a whole wide range of other weird phenomena.
Wow. I was actually just recently rereading Whitley Strieber's Communion, and one of the things he mentions, one of the first hypnosis sessions he goes under, he remembers them showing a picture of him in like this big open field with his son in it. And he recounts his son moving really, really oddly, like he was uncomfortable in his own body, and when he turns around, his entire eyes are completely black.
Right.
And
Whitley and I have talked about that some because I was on Dreamland a while back, and Whitley has seen one of these black-eyed children himself.
Oh, that I didn't know.
If you go back and listen to the episode of Dreamland that I was on, he gives his full account on that episode.
Nice. All right. Does there seem to be a point to any of these encounters? Do you have any idea what they ultimately want?
You know, I sort of think that the point to the encounters is to create this high level of fear in the victims. You know, whether it's to feed off of that energetically, or whether it's, you know, a lot of people say that these accounts, it almost sounds like some kind of a test is being run, you know, as if they're just trying different things out. So ultimately, we really don't know.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Your book, of course, The Black Eyed Children, it's not on Amazon. It's only available through Leprechaun Press?
That's correct.
And
LeprechaunPress.com.
Okay. And is it ever going to be on Amazon, or?
Probably not.
Okay.
Just directly from the publisher.
All right. And your website, you have a blog.
Yes, I do.
And that is what?
That is twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. And that is TWOCROWS paranormal.blogspot.com. There's links on there to my Facebook. People are welcome to find me on Facebook and get a Twitter feed and all that jazz. There are accounts on there that have come in since the book has come out that people have sent to me that I've investigated, as well as a wide range of other things. You know, I was out investigating around Area 51 recently, so there's information on there about that. And I'm in the field a lot, so, you know, everything from investigating cryptids to UFO sightings to haunted sites.
Wow, okay. And I was going to ask you something else real quick. Oh, you got another book coming out this year.
I do. It should be out in March. It's called Strange Intruders, and it covers a bit more about the djinn, the grinning man. It'll talk about the slender man, who appears to be some type of a tulpa, as well as a few other interesting topics.
All right. Well, I look forward to that.
That'll be from Leprechaun Press also.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Anything else we didn't cover people should know?
No, I think we're good. Go to my blog, and of course the book is at leprechaunpress.com.
All right. I thank you very much, David. And we're going to take you out of the show and into the last exit for the lost with some Psyche Corporation with Whirring World. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Soraya. It's been a pleasure.
Come in. Understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you?